Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome to The Critic's podcast. Introducing The Critic's new column, This Sporting Life, Graham Stewart talks to the sports writer Boris Starling about the enduring appeal of a British Lions tour and the players who regard it to be more memorable than winning the Rugby World Cup.
Boris Starling in this month's edition of The Critic magazine in the new The Sporting Life section. You write about the forthcoming British and Irish Lions tour of South Africa. The Lions, I mean, they're a rather sort of strange sporting outlier in many ways. I mean, we expect the players of the various four nations to put their own nation first, and through the Six Nations and the World Cup, they do so. And yet, the Lions does seem to mean a lot to them, as it does to their supporters across the British Isles. Given the sporadic nature of Lions tours, I mean, they tour the Southern Hemisphere once every 4 years, how has it managed to sustain this level of interest for so long?
I think the sporadic nature of it is probably part of what helps it. As you say, it's once every 4 years, and they go to Australia, New Zealand, South Africa in turn. Therefore, they go to each of those countries once every 12 years. And therefore, you know, and fundamentally for all but 2 months every 4 years, they don't even really exist. They have a separate management structure, a separate corporate structure. They're not chosen by anything to do with the Six Nations or the Home Nations or World Rugby. And they have just sort of taken on a life of their own. And it's one of those things that it would never start, were you to start it now, rather like the royal family, were you to start them now, they would never happen, because there's so many reasons that they are illogical. But they go back in history a long way. I mean, the first Lions, they go back 100 years or more. And over the years, the sort of the history has added each time. I mean, it used to be irregular and sporadic in amateur days. In the famous 1974 tour, I think it was about 4 months. And you know, there were people, Ian McGeachan, who was a player then, who then became Lions head coach. He had to go to his bank manager and ask for, you know, a 4 month pause on the mortgage. He's a teacher, and he wasn't getting, you know, I think he had a per diem in South Africa. But they played something like 22 matches, were undefeated. At a time when the Springboks were obviously not involved in international sports of apartheid, and therefore the Springboks had this great idea that they were the sort of, you know, uncrowned world champions, and the Lions put paid to that. But ever since then it's been, or ever since professionalism, it's been once every 4 years in strict rotation, and people, you know, each layer sort of builds on the iteration before. Spectators save up, you know, to go on a thing of a lifetime. They go out there for months at a time in a way that they don't do for England or Wales or Scotland. And it's just become this huge thing. And for any home nations player, it is the absolute pinnacle. It's unique in so many ways, even down to the way that they're not just chosen, but announced. When I did Openside, Sam Warburton's autobiography, I ghosted it. He captained twice in 2013 to Australia and 2017 in New Zealand. Both times, the captain is told in advance or asked in advance, and then no one ever turns it down. And then, so he was taken down to, I think it was Sion House or Sion Park, and then sort of presented to the media. But everybody else finds out the same way the public do, by watching it on TV. And so you had this, you know, and you can find it on social media, you had these amazing scenes in the Gloucester clubhouse where all the Gloucester team are watching the announcement, just like I was. And then Chris Harris gets announced and they all mob him. And they had these very flimsy sort of plastic social distancing screens that lasted about a nanosecond with some overexcited 120-kilo behemoth leaping over them. And then Lewis Rees-Zammit got announced. And you saw what it meant, not just to the player selected, but to all their club teammates who wouldn't have a hope in hell of being selected. But they all understand the magnitude of it. And I think it's also because... And the Lions are this sort of this strange, tiny invading army of there's, I mean, the number of players varies. It's normally between 35 and 40, and then probably the same again of support staff and so on. So you're talking 80 people maximum going around a country which is hostile, not in a physical way, but certainly in rugby terms. And therefore you have to rely entirely on each other. And all those national rivalries, which, as you say, you know, run very, very deep. These players only ever play each other at international level. You know, they play in the Six Nations, maybe in the World Cup. Those Six Nations rivalries, again, go on year after year after year. And each year is another layer, another iteration. And they run deep. And suddenly, in 6 weeks or less, you have to become friends, teammates, brothers in arms of people who you've only ever seen, you know, across the top of a sweaty, heaving, steaming scrum.
And sometimes has that gone wrong? I mean, have there been Lions tours where the chemistry is not bonded together and players from the different home nations, frankly, they didn't like each other beforehand and they like each other no better for having to share a team bus and a hotel?
There definitely have been. There are two possible splits in Lions tours and both over the years have come to pass. One is the sort of national clique, especially at a time when one team is very dominant, when one of the home nations is very dominant, whether there's too many English players, too many Welsh players, people can retreat into cliques. But the other thing is that often on a Lions tour, obviously, sooner or later it splits into the test team who will play the three test matches against the home nation, and the midweek team. They always play four or five warm-up matches against provinces, franchises, whatever, where they mix and match, looking for the best combinations. But the pecking order always becomes clear, because it always does. And keeping that midweek team on board is absolutely critical. In the 1993 tour of New Zealand, the midweek team went badly off reservation and basically stopped caring. Bizarrely, the only one the midweek team who conducted himself in exemplary fashion was Will Carling, who was England captain and probably rugby's biggest superstar at the time, because it was pre-Jonah Lomu. And Carling had every right to expect a place in the test team and had actually been overlooked in favour of Scott Gibbs. And whether Carling was stung by this or whatever reason, he actually led the midweek team exceptionally well, but most of them weren't interested. 4 years later, when the Lions went to South Africa in 97, which is still held up as the most famous tour for many, many reasons, they didn't make that mistake. They chose and they chose players not just on the basis of how good they were, but also their character as well. And they said right at the start, there are no preconceived ideas here. There are no plays. There are no names on seats, no names on jerseys. You are all playing with a genuine shot of it. And it turned out that was the case, that both props, Tom Smith and Paul Wallace, and one of the locks, Jamie Davidson, if you'd picked a team when they left Heathrow, they would have been nowhere near the test team, but they played themselves in and therefore they got their reward. And that sends a message to everybody on that tour that actually everyone is being treated fairly. And keeping an entire tour on the same team sheet, on the same hymn sheet, sorry, is absolutely critical in terms of a tour success.
Well, there are probably lessons for management on how to build a Lions team, which are in some ways more pertinent, some of the kind of lessons of captaincy books that come out from time to time about national sides. The choice of coach is obviously central. I mean, we've got Warren Gatland. I mean, to what extent is the team Gatland's personal choice, or are there pressures, you know, to make sure there's a more balanced representation of the four nations in a way in which, you know, might not be a fair representation of their, you know, their balance of their competing talents at any one time?
Very good question. The team is entirely Gatland's choice and his coaching staff, and it has to be. And his point, you know, Gatland has historically been associated with Wales. He coached Wales for a long time. You know, Sam Warburton was his captain there, and I think Gatland has a tendency, perhaps, to go in a tight situation for the players he knows better than the ones he doesn't. That doesn't make him alone. There's always this kind of thing about how many players from each nation there is, and that has, over the last few years, especially been the case with Scotland, who have been not so much underrepresented, but they simply haven't been playing that well. Therefore, they've had very few players. They have many more players this time because they have a much better team. But I think Gatland's point is fundamentally, once you're on tour, you're all Lions. In the same way that in Wales there are four professional rugby teams. There's the Cardiff Blues, the Ospreys, the Scarlets, and the Dragons. But yet, when they play for Wales, they're all Welsh. And it's just one layer up from that. Once you're a Lion, you're a Lion. And the quicker you forget your home nation, the better.
Boris, you talk in your article for this month's Critic about Sam Warburton, who captained in 2013 and 2017. Warburton, as a boy, had this replica Lions kit, which he clearly cherished. Is the Lions kit, isn't it a bit like the way in which Australia's cricketers endlessly bang on reverentially about the traditions of the baggy green?
It is a little bit like that. I mean, the Aussies go on about the baggy green. They have that thing that they always wear it for the first fielding session of a test and so on. I think the Lions jersey, as far as I know, is one of the best-selling replica jerseys out there. You know, again, they only, of course, ever get it every 4 years. But in Sam's case, his parents gave him that jersey when he was, I think, 16. It was for the 2005 tour. And he had a number 7 on the back because he played 7. And he wore it for months and months and months. Then he put it in a drawer and said, next time I wear one, will be for real. And the night before the first test of the 2013 tour, his first test as captain in Brisbane, they were all given their jerseys. You know, the handing out the jerseys is a very solemn ceremony, and it's always done by some, you know, Ali Cardew or great retired player who gives wordable words about the magnitude of the occasion. And they were asked whether they wanted to give their jersey back to the kit man and then see it in the dressing room the next day or take it with them. He said, no, I'll take mine with me. And he laid it out in his bed. And he went down and he went to the door to go out down to supper. And he came back to look at the jersey, went to the door, came back again, and only on the third time managed to leave the room because it meant that much to him. And it is a very, I guess, it's a sacred tunic to those people.
And how does it compare to you? How does it compare winning a Lions Test series to winning the World Cup? England players really need only apply here, but there's not very many Lions players who've had that joint honour. But what was more important to them, I wonder?
It's only the dozen or so who played on the 97 Lions tour and were in the 2003 World Cup squad to whom that applies. I mean, I do remember there was a time when Lawrence Dallaglio, who was one of those, and in fact, Lawrence, along with Matt Dawson, is also the only player to have won a World Sevens Cup, a World Fifteens Cup, and a Lions tour. But that's by the by. He was asked what was more special, a Lions win or a World Cup? And he said a Lions win, and he didn't even hesitate. And I think his logic was that fundamentally, when you're a Lion, you are this tiny sort of invading army, you know, like Cortez and the Conquistadors, you know, far from home, and it's just you against the world. When you're in a World Cup, there's 20 teams that then get whittled down to 8, to 4, to 2. But you're fundamentally, you know, you're one of many contestants. When you're the Lions, it's just you against the world. And I think also that 97 tour that he referred to was special for lots of reasons. Not just that they picked so well. It was the first one in the professional era. The Springboks were world champions. And there's a nice little oddity. The Springboks tend to win the World Cup at exact 12-year intervals, which coincides with the 12-year intervals that the Lions go there. So the Lions always go there to face the world champions, as they do now. But also it was just after professionalism. Therefore, the rugby league boys had come back to union because they can now get paid. And they brought with them this professionalism in terms of attitude and so on that the union boys didn't have before. And that was summed up by Scott Gibbs, who was player of the series that year. Gibbs was a Welsh centre who was a ferocious competitor. And he would stand there, he would stand yelling at the opposition, you know, yelling at the opposition back row who were much bigger than him, you know, run at me, dickhead. And Jerry Guscott, who played outside him, you know, Guscott was still, I think, the most elegant player I've seen in 40 years of watching rugby. Guscott would tug on his jersey and go, what are you doing? You're winding them up. He goes, exactly. And it was that sort of confrontational attitude that the union boys hadn't had. And the league boys brought back, and all this. Oh, and the fact that they chose Martin Johnson as captain, and he'd only captained Leicester a dozen times, but McGeachan and Telfer saw something in him that they just knew would be not just a good captain, but the right captain for South Africa, where physicality is such a huge thing. And all these things coalesced in a perfect storm to make that tour so wonderful. And so I think when Lawrence talks about that being the greatest experience of his rugby life and greater than the World Cup, it's not just the winning of the series, it's all that went into that as well.
Well, I mean, you talk about the Springboks being the current World Cup champions, and you know, this being coming around every 12 years in the Republic of South Africa. I'm wondering if there's a bit of a hierarchy between the three main Southern Hemisphere teams that the Lions play. I mean, just looking at the record, the Lions have got a very good record against the Wallabies. They've won 7 tests, lost 6. Not so good against the Springboks, 117, lost 23. And the All Blacks, understandable reasons, have proved tough nuts to crack. Lions 1-7, lost 30. Is there still a sense that it's the All Blacks are really the huge challenge, and the others are, I mean, but playing the Springboks in South Africa is never light. But if you're playing against Australia, well, the Australians are also fixated with Aussie rules and league rugby as well. So is there a hierarchy, or does it certainly not feel like that if you've got various Wallabies charging towards you?
I'd imagine that various Wallabies charging towards you would concentrate the mind to pretty much the exclusion of all else. I think when you're in it, there's probably no hierarchy, but if you take the wider picture, there definitely is. I mean, and again, I spoke about this to Sam Warburton, and we wrote it in his book that he won the series against Australia 2-1, and they drew the series against the All Blacks 1 each with a draw. And I said, I said to him when we were doing our sessions, if you could take one, what would it be? He said, well, it'd have to be Australia because it's all about winning. But he said, by any rational yardstick, drawing against the All Blacks was a far greater achievement. They are and have been for a long, long time, and will be for a long, long time, the benchmark of world rugby. And interestingly, just on the aside, when the South Africa won the World Cup, the year before the World Cup, they went to New Zealand and they beat New Zealand 36-34, having lost to them 57-0 their previous match. And they put all their eggs into the basket of that return match on the grounds that to win the World Cup, they would either have to beat New Zealand away or beat someone who'd beat New Zealand away. And so for them, as for the Lions, as for everybody, New Zealand are the benchmark. The previous tour before 2017 was 2005 when the All Blacks won 3-0. And frankly, they could have played 10 tests and won 10-0. I mean, they were just that much better. So I think, although the All Blacks are the hardest to go to, I think South Africa has always been the tour for the Lions, partly because of the country is so beautiful, not that New Zealand isn't, but the weather is good, and partly because it's always been tight. It's always been, I mean, the every single test of the professional era, or certainly every single test when the series has still been live, has been absolutely titanic, and there's been nothing in it. Whereas there have been tests where the All Blacks have run rampant, and it's been very one-sided, but South Africa and the Lions is always, I think, the most equal matchup, and it comes with so much. And so, yes, I think in pure rugby terms, New Zealand is the ultimate. But to take it overall, I think South Africa is just has the edge.
And finally, Boris, as we get ready for South Africa, what do you sense is the mood music in both the Lions and the Springboks? Equals levels of confidence, or what's the pre-test psychology looking like?
It's very hard to tell because the Springboks haven't played a test match since the World Cup final in November 2019, so 18 months ago. Whereas the Lions obviously haven't played as the Lions, but everyone playing in them has played in 2 Six Nations, plus there was the Autumn Nations Cup or whatever it was called last year, that was a sort of fill in for this, that, and the other. So South Africa should be quite seriously undercooked. They've been playing, they've been playing franchise rugby, but only within South Africa. Normally they play Super Rugby, South Africa, Australia, New Zealand franchise sides. They haven't been doing that because of COVID. They haven't travelled. So, I mean, the Lions have got a great chance to catch South Africa cold in the first test. But again, with the Lions, it's always hard. You're trying to to create a scratch team from zero in a few weeks flat. So there are far more unknowns this time than there have been before. So I think the mood music is so difficult to read that until it all kicks off the first test. I mean, you will get a sense of it in terms of the provincial games that the Lions are playing. But again, the Springbok members of those provinces, you know, won't be playing against them. They'll be pulled out to stay in Springbok camp. So until kickoff on the first test on the 24th of July, it's anyone's guess. I've been writing the autobiography of Siya Kolisi, the Springbok captain, that it's just as big a thing for the Springboks as it is for the Lions. And that, you know, and he said, short of a World Cup, this is as big as it gets. Everyone is desperate for them to come. Everyone's so glad that the tour is still on, even without traveling spectators. You know, there were plenty of players, South African, New Zealand, Australians, who, you know, no matter how great they are, never get to play the Lions just because their careers start and finish within those 12 years. And so, you know, everyone in South Africa is absolutely desperate to get at them. So we shall see.
Well, we shall indeed. Boris Starling, who writes about the forthcoming Lions tour in The Sporting Life, the new sporting section of the Critic magazine. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.